We're going to move on to item seven, which is our review of private credit. We are going to have a presentation from staff, and then we have a presentation from StepZone. And I know I see Rishi is on, and there's Mr. Price as well. So Rishi, I believe this is your item. If you would take over, the floor is yours.
Well, dude, thanks, Scott. Let me share my screen. Okay, can everyone see private credit overview? It's the first page. Okay, great.
Yes, we see it.
So it's nice to see everyone again. It's time for our annual presentation on Cicero's private credit program, where we go a little bit more in depth into a review of the program. I'm going to be brief this year and just have a couple of intro slides, and then I'm going to hand it over to StepZone, StepZone's private debt team, and they're going to cover the meat of the presentation. That said, feel free to jump in at any point if you have questions. I'll also pause at the end of my intro if there are any questions for me. So let's get started. Page two of my presentation shows where private credit sits in the growth bucket within Cicero's portfolio. As you probably recall, the board approved a modest increase in the private credit allocation from 12% to 13% in December 2020 as part of the new asset allocation. And StepZone will speak to deployment pace and when we're expected to hit that 13% target allocation in more detail during their presentation. Moving on to page three, this shows the key participants involved in Cicero's private credit program. I think the key takeaway here is that StepZone has discretion for implementing the private credit program, and investment staff monitors StepZone's implementation. I think it's worth noting that within Cicero's broader private markets program, this implementation structure is unique. So we have a different structure in private equity, for example, and private equity investment staff uses delegated authority to implement the private equity program. And so investment staff lead sourcing, due diligence, execution, et cetera. This is not the case with private credit. Staff does not use delegated authority. Instead, StepZone has discretion for implementation of the program. That said, a chunk of time and effort goes into monitoring StepZone's implementation. So, you know, let me provide some tangible examples for how staff does that. We speak to StepZone at least every other week and discuss a variety of topics, including market updates. We exchange ideas on new strategies and managers. We get updates on existing managers and portfolio performance. We talk about reporting requirements. And then periodically, we have sort of bigger picture monitoring discussions where we ask questions like, you know, are we accomplishing what we set out to do in our private credit program? Are the individual managers performing as we expected? Are we getting the investment exposures that we expected? Are there any managers we should consider dropping for any reason? Are there any exposures we'd like to build in the coming year or years? And then in addition to those sort of twice a month check-ins, and the level of engagement between staff and StepZone typically intensifies when StepZone is evaluating a new prospective investment manager for the portfolio. Staff reviews StepZone's due diligence in detail, and we typically have follow-ups for StepZone and for the investment managers being considered. So, you know, those are a few tangible examples of how Cicero investment staff monitors StepZone's implementation of the program. That's all I had planned for this morning. I wanted to be brief, but, you know, before I hand it off to StepZone, let me pause here to see if there are any questions for me.
I had one, Rishi, or at least one, which is currently how many managers is StepZone managing in this program?
Sure. So there are 20 managers in the program. Now, that said, we have some managers that are managing co-investments, which are very small dollar amounts. So I'd say the way to think about the portfolio is, you know, we just signed up our fifth SMA, separately managed account. And so those are with five different managers. Those dollar amounts tend to be in the $150 to $350 million range per separately managed account. So that's really the bulk of the exposure in the program. And then we have, you know, a handful of primary fund managers. Those are commitments to commingled funds where we're one of many LPs. And then, you know, we have sort of, I think, 12 co-investments in the portfolio, which are smaller dollar amounts. So that's sort of how the the portfolio is divided. In total, it's about 20 managers, but really five make up the lion's share of the portfolio.
And those five are the separately managed accounts?
Those five are the separately managed accounts, correct.
And those five are under the direction of StepStone, correct?
Those five are under the direction of investment managers. So StepStone, so there are five different investment managers that manage those accounts. And StepStone, you know, is involved in the bottom-up selection of those investment managers, the top-down strategy selection that goes into deciding which managers to pursue. They negotiate the terms of those separately managed accounts, and staff sort of walk side by side with them and monitors and ask questions along the way. Does that answer the question, Scott?
Yes. And the final question is, and I think I know the answer to this, but in terms of our quarterly reporting, so when we're looking at portfolio performance, and Varys is taking us through our various results, when we look at private credit, we're sort of looking at a top line of StepStone, right? We're not actually looking at the myriad of individual investments or managers beneath them. Is that fair?
Correct. And I think that's a great clarification. So we're looking at the top line. We are invested in a fund of one structure with StepStone. So, you know, that's a sort of a fancy way of saying we're in a fund where we're the only LP, limited partner in the fund, and StepStone manages that fund. And then within that fund, we have all of these individual manager exposures. And so what's reported to the board is just that top line fund of one performance is what the board sees. And that fund of one performance, which StepStone will go through today, is net of all fees. So it's fees to StepStone as well as fees paid to the managers.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll leave it there. You have a calendar reminder that popped up, I think, on your screen. Just so
yes.
You
know. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Hey, Rishi?
Hi, Dr. Paul.
Yeah, so looking at all the fees involved, the managers charge their own fee, and then StepStone charges a fee on top of that. So when we're looking at our returns, we are looking at everything net of fees. Is that correct?
Correct. So, you know, we're going to show, and StepStone will show in their presentation, they'll show two levels of net returns. They'll show net, so net of everything. So the manager fees and StepStone fees. And then they'll also show a return that shows net of just the manager fees. So you'll be able to see the delta between just the manager fees and the manager fees plus StepStone's fees in the performance, if that makes sense.
Okay. It kind of seems like this is like a fund of funds kind of situation. And I know we were trying to get away from that in our investments. And so maybe StepStone or you can highlight if that is actually the case, or if there's a difference from what we are trying to get away from to what we have with StepStone now.
Right. And I might take a stab at this and then maybe even pull Tim in, because the structure was created, you know, I think late 2017, early 2018, this fund of one structure. And you're right in a way that it is closer to a fund of fund fund-to-fund structure that we are using. It's a little bit different than the fund-to-fund structures that we're trying to get away from in private equity, in that, you know, in those private equity funds, we're one of several LPs, limited partners, in those fund structures. And so you have one manager that's managing a fund with several investors like Cicera. And here, it's a fund of one structure where, you know, I'd argue that the collaboration and coordination needs to be a little bit more, a little closer between the, you know, StepStone and the team. But in terms of the, you know, the double layer of fees, I think that's accurate. I will say that the fee amount that StepStone receives, you know, is not comparable. So I think it's lower than the fee amounts that we pay to fund-to-fund managers on the private equity side. But yeah, I don't know if Tim wants to add anything about sort of structure and history when this was set up, which, you know, precedes me joining.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just really briefly on that point. When we were launching the private credit program, we looked at various implementation options, including a more traditional consulting relationship where we would be brought individual strategies, then have to underwrite them and move forward. I think one of the areas we were concerned about at the time was some of the terms that were being offered up within private credit. So we're all well aware that, credit contingencies wax and wane depending on how strong the market is. And one of the things we wanted to make sure we did within the private credit space was have control over the terms. So if we were going to be going into a series of funds, you kind of accept the fund's underwriting in terms of who they're going to lend to, how many covenants they're going to have, how creditworthy the counterparty is. And we knew we wanted to go down a path where we had a little bit more control over that in setting minimum credit underwriting standards, minimum collateral standards, having control over the investment policy statement, et cetera. And so we had very quickly settled on we wanted to have the bulk of our exposure in separately managed accounts. That said, separately managed accounts within private credit get a little bit tricky because they're not treated the same as private equity or private real estate funds are under California law. And so in order to maintain the same levels of protection we have in terms of, only disclosing the pertinent information and not getting into the details, you had to have another manager kind of on top of the separately managed accounts to provide that oversight. So that fiduciary oversight needed to be external from Cicera. And so this is the format we settled on. Yes, it is a fund to one, and Dr. McDonald, you're right to raise the issue of the fees there. I think when we looked at this at the time, the fee level at the StepStone level was the most competitive option we saw in the marketplace at the time in terms of offering that fiduciary oversight that was external to Cicera. And, so it was the combination of there needed to be an external fiduciary. And we needed to be able to, we believed we needed to be able to set the credit underwriting standards in these separately managed accounts. So this was a hybrid compromise that we think is, it certainly has its pros and cons, but it was the solution that was adopted by the board at that time.
Any other questions for Rishi or Tim on the private credit overview before we turn it over to StepStone? Not seeing none, so let us move forward. Rishi, I'll let you introduce StepStone. I see we have Marcel, Ariel, and Urs. It looks like they have all joined us, so I'll let you introduce StepStone, and we'll take it from there.
Great. Yeah, you've seen all of them on the screen already, but yeah, we have Marcel Schindler and Urs von Buren. They're partners based in Zurich, and we have Ariel Goldblatt. She's a partner based in the private on the private debt team based in New York. Can we please make Ariel a presenter? And with that, StepStone private debt team, the floor is yours.
Perfect. Thank you, Rishi, and thank you, Cicera Board. I will attempt to share my screen. That'll let me, since perfect.
And meanwhile, I'll already start, Ariel. So good morning to everyone, and thank you very much for being here again. According to my count, it's the fourth review meeting that we're able to carry out this year. A pleasure again, and I hope next time we will make it actually in person. First of all, I would like to thank the board and the trustee for the continued trust, and especially the investment team as well for the intense and good cooperation during the year. If we look at the presentation, I would like to keep especially the first part about the group very brief. StepStone Group has been able overall to grow its business successfully as well during the pandemic, and went through a public listing at NASDAQ. If you look at the numbers that you see here, they're already overhauled because we closed the transaction and acquired another business in the venture capital space, private equity venture capital space, and are more than 700 people now that work for StepStone. If I talk now for StepStone Group, the private debt team, represented by me, I'm heading that together with my partners, Ariel, and Urs von Buren. We have grown in line with the overall business. We oversee a bit more than 40 billion on an annual basis. We commit about 10 billion, which means we are among the largest allocators in the business, which I think is important to negotiate, especially for what we mentioned or discussed before already, the separately managed account, very special fee terms and conditions and underwriting standards that otherwise are not available in the market, and that we use normally for our separately managed accounts and those that we set up for the clients like Cicera. With that, Ariel, I would like to go just very briefly to page number six, actually. And to page number six, you know, just mention we've grown our private debt team in line with the asset management growth that we had. I think that's the first comment I would like to make. And we had two new partner promotions, which I believe is important as well in leading the overall business. That's Jan Kuhlmann, and it's Ariel that is today in the day-to-day business and management of your portfolio. With that, I would like to spend some time before we can look into the review of the mandate, go through the market.
May have lost you there.
Marcel, I think we lost you.
Although if he's really lost, he may not be hearing you. So.
Yeah. He's moving now.
Okay, but that's good. He may have frozen.
Can you hear me again?
I can hear you. Yep, we can hear you.
Oh, fantastic. Apologies. It seems I was traveling, so my internet connection seems not to be very, very stable. So I think the good news looking at the core part of the portfolio, which is direct lending, is that the asset class direct lending really proved to be resilient. Here we do a comparison actually with those public markets which are closest to direct lending, which is the high yield bond market and the syndicated loan market. And if you compare this during global financial crisis, but now as well during the COVID crisis, what we can see clearly, drawdowns that you see at the bottom left of the chart, they have been much more muted than in public markets. And so we believe truly in terms of protection of capital, this asset class really achieved the goals that we have set originally. Now, if we move forward on the next page, I think it's not just the point that actually it proved the resilience during the crisis. I think interesting, the crisis itself, plus the intervention by states, central banks actually have led to a consequence that we see here. Relative attractiveness of private debt, direct lending compared to similar credit risk markets in the public space, high yield and syndicated loan, have become more attractive. What we show here is the absolute yield difference between direct lending against syndicated loan market and high yield bond market. And what you see, we have an absolute yield pickup of 300 to 400 basis points, which we believe is extremely attractive still in the current environment. Now, this relative attractiveness, when we move on to the next page, we're not just finding in the corporate lending space. We see that as across all private market space, and especially the private debt space as well in real estate, infrastructure, and other lending strategies, on which we will touch as well very briefly during the presentation. All have exhibited extreme resilience during the crisis and offer post-crisis actually rather attractive credit spreads.
Can I ask a question? This may be trite to some, but when you're referring to the crisis, I'm assuming you're discussing the overall effects of the pandemic. But I think as we've seen the market's performance during this period has been an anomaly to many, certainly to us or to me. And so when you talk about the crisis, I just want to make sure I understand what crisis specifically you're getting at.
Yes, no, it's truly the phase. If you think about, and if you go one slide back, Ariel, I think that shows it best. You know, it has been Q2 of 2020 because post Q2, monetary intervention have been so strongly, but especially in public markets, that we've seen a significant recovery, which has compressed spreads, mainly though in public markets and a bit less in private markets. And that is one of the reasons why actually we see that the relative attractiveness has increased, because more money was flowing in public markets than it was into private markets over the same period post-crisis. Whatever we will consider this crisis period, I think it's not yet clearly defined if it's, you know, February to kind of June, July of 2020, but that's probably one of the periods I will consider as crisis period.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I just want to generally differentiate when we usually talk about the global financial crisis and we look at the extended nature of that and its effect, the Q2 2020 matter. I guess it certainly felt like a crisis at the time. I don't know how I'd describe it, but I just wanted to be sure I understood what generally you were speaking to in terms of.
I fully understand. I think the big difference is, you know, if you look back into April 2020, if central banks and governments wouldn't have reacted as fast as they did, probably the overall implication would have looked rather similar to GFC. We did a lot of analysis across the portfolios and the credits overall, but obviously the massive interventions have helped dramatically in the markets.
All right, thank you.
So if we move to page number 12, I was talking about the relative attractiveness, but if I make some observation about the absolute levels of returns and risks, I think the first observation looking at overall yields, yes, we had a yield widening. We had higher yields during the pandemic, but they came in very fast post-pandemic. So overall absolute level is more or less back to pre-crisis level. Considering though that the risk-free rate is actually lower, the net spread that we get for credit risk is actually higher. So that's still an attractive feature in the asset class. If you look at risk parameters, just mentioning two here, which we've chosen leverage and loan to values. As well, during the pandemic, obviously, companies were lent less money. So loan to values, leverage was lower. That as well came back very fast post-pandemic. So people are lending money again for acquisition, for transactions. But what we see, LTVs never came back to the same level. This is though primarily as well a fact that probably the absolute amount of money that was lent is still the same, but purchase acquisition multiples went up, but the private equity sponsors normally put in more money directly, which means to cushion the protection in that sense below the senior lending, which we do for your mandate, is normally better than it was pre-crisis. If we move on to the next page, there are those some observations as well that we made that have to be watched out in the market. So, I mean, one of the elements that we love about direct lending is credit are protected by covenants that we get in these transactions. Covenants you don't find anymore in public markets. Syndicated loans normally don't have covenants. High-yield bonds don't have either. So in direct lending, though, we've seen now post-pandemic actually a trend that covenant-light situations entered into the market. The good news for Contra Costa is definitely working through the separately managed accounts, investment guidelines that we have set, we can clearly limit this dilution of the quality of credit in the portfolios. The challenge that I show on the lower part of this chart has to do with repayments in the market. So what we found is that over the last quarters, repayments of these transactions, refinancing, have accelerated. And that in general is not a bad thing when credit gets paid back. But for an investor that is a forward challenge to a certain degree to remain invested. So overall, we believe reinvestment challenge becomes bigger in the market. And that is one of the reasons why we will talk then on the next page, what we are focusing on, which is actually as well finding different type of options to reinvest money. So in summary, to the market, what I wanted to show, good resilience has been proven. The portfolio was very stable. Challenges that we have going forward, there might be some more spread tightening. Leverage and LTVs and covenant lights are coming into the market. And the refinancing make it harder to actually deploy the money on an ongoing basis. How do we actually address this in all our portfolios for the LPs? First of all, we believe in diversification. And if we talk about diversification, it's not just diversification, risk return, but as well having other deployment options if these refinancings come in. Second is remaining selective in a market like this. We've all seen valuations where they're driving towards. We do this primarily for contra costa by means of setting investment guidelines, what the GPs really can do in these separately managed accounts. So we have a good quality control over the credits that get into your mandate. Other means are secondary and co-investments, about which actually Ariel will talk in a minute. And then I believe it's important to evaluate continued deployment options in the market, even if they're lower yielding, because the worst is actually to sit on cash over time. We will see as well, when we talk about market trends in a second, other investment options, because companies have to refinance and finance themselves differently, especially if they're in a transition of the business model, are opening up new funding gaps and new opportunities for financing, which come to the investors with very attractive spreads. So this in very short to the market. If there are any questions before I hand over to Ariel, I'm happy to take them.
I had one, and that is, in terms of covenant light, what's the most significant covenant that the covenant light model either modifies or eliminates?
I think I let Urs take this question. Is that okay, Urs?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. In most cases, it's a leverage covenant left. So there's a lot of transactions that have now one covenant, probably 50 to 60%. If there is a second one, there is a fixed charge cover covenant, which means the cash flow earned needs to cover the interest plus repayments at least one time. So the before covenant light comes in and there's no covenant, the last one to go is the leverage covenant, which allows to step in, ask for extra capital to be put in by the owner of the company, to increase the pricing, to tighten the documentation. It's the leverage covenant that goes last.
All right, thank you.
With this, Ariel, I think we hand over to some market trends and how we look into those.
Great. Thanks, Marcel. Appreciate it. So I'll talk a little bit about the co-investment market dynamics to start with. As you can see from the chart, there are almost 4,000 primary transactions completed per year in the US and Europe. And you know, the number of funds and the dollar amount of funds raised has just continued to balloon since the great financial crisis. And then despite COVID, I think what's most interesting is private debt experienced record deployment in 2020, and that deployment has continued into 2021. A little bit about the early days of COVID. So when COVID first hit, we were seeing improved spread and pricing by about 100 bips, and actually lower leverage levels for very high quality borrowers. So leverage was down, call it a half to one turn. And now in 2021, we're still seeing high quality borrowers, but pricing and leverage levels have come in to be more in line with pre-COVID levels. So, you know, why do we like co-investments? We think there are many benefits of co-investments for limited partners, including, you know, better returns than a typical fund investment, as they're usually sourced on a no fee, no carry basis. They also can result in faster capital deployment, which everyone knows is very important in private debt, and also just further portfolio diversification by manager, by industry, et cetera. And it's also important that, you know, GPs benefit from co-investments too. You know, it enables them to not have to syndicate to competitors, and also enables them to develop closer relationships with their existing LPs and get to know new LPs. And one of the key challenges for co-investments and why not all LPs participate is that, unlike private equity co-investments, in which an LP has several months to get comfortable with a transaction, in private debt, these co-investments run on a very tight timeline. And usually, you know, co-investments will close, you know, within 1 month of an initial review. So as a result, in order to execute on co-investments, you need to have a dedicated team that can drill into diligence in an efficient manner in order to meet these tight timelines. And then moving to the secondary market dynamics, this has become, a very large market, but private debt in particular is actually a small portion of the overall secondary market, but it is growing rapidly. A few things to note about private debt secondaries versus private equity secondaries. For private debt secondaries, they have a much shorter duration than private equity secondaries. And as a result, we never expect there to be as big of an LP secondary market as there is in private equity. Instead, we expect the GP-led secondaries to be a much bigger portion of the private debt secondary market. And then similar to co-investments, secondaries provide LPs with many benefits, right? Faster deployment and turnaround on distributions, which improves your cash on cash returns, as well as the ability to buy portfolios at a discount to your net asset value, which can also result in enhanced returns. And then similar to co-investments as well, GPs benefit from secondaries as it enables them to develop closer relationships with their existing and new LPs. And also, as it relates to GP-led secondaries, it can free up capital for new investments and reduce individual position concentrations. Similar to co-investments in terms of challenges, the secondaries do tend to run on a tight timeline as well. And so having a dedicated team that can execute efficiently is quite important. And then as we think about...
Sorry to interrupt. Just a question back on co-investments.
Sure.
For the co-investments that Cesera's are involved in, I just wanted to clarify who has discretion in executing those. And I'm just curious, it seems like it's maybe one out of 10, slightly less than that in terms of kind of approval. What are the main reasons for kind of not participating in a co-investment? And also, if Cesera's, if we're in a co-investment, what for the co-investment, I guess, section of the program overall, is there, I'm wondering about the LIBOR transition and if there's any complications related to that.
Sure. I'll start and let me know if I miss any of your questions. So first on, in terms of who has discretion at StepStone, so we have a co-investment committee. All co-investments that make it past being desk-killed and come to the committee then has discretion to approve or not approve a co-investment. And then those are allocated to Cesera based on their investment guidelines, if they fit or do not fit. In terms of what makes a good co-investment, or why we choose a certain co-investment versus, kill another co-investment. We have just as we do for our entire platform, we have specific guidelines that we tend to follow that we believe result in lower loss rates. And so, for example, we specifically want to make sure we have reasonable leverage, reasonable LTV levels. So overall, a very good risk adjusted return. We also focus to make sure that there is a covenant in every single one of our co-investments. And we also think about the portfolio overall in terms of any concentrations by not only by industry, but by GP, by sponsor, et cetera. And so all of those factors come into immediate play whenever we're looking at a co-investment. And then as we dig in deeper into due diligence, we, then we'll also find other reasons that potentially, there's concentration, with suppliers or customers that may not make sense. And that can be another reason why we would, for example, kill a co-investment. And then in terms of the transition from LIBOR, every single one of our credit agreements actually has has language that would enable us to transition to the new rate once it becomes regulated in the next couple of years and becomes mandated. So there won't be any hiccup in terms of co-investments, and that's similar across our platform. Please, Jay, let me know if I missed any of your questions.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Perfect.
Ariel? Before, and I've lost track of which slide it's on, but we talk about discounting purchase prices. If there is a discount, who is paying that?
Yeah, so it so there's a couple things. So if it's an LP secondary, I think that's what you're referring to.
Here it is. Yes, I see it. Yep.
So if you're
a discount.
Exactly. So for a variety of reasons, LPs will sometimes need to sell their stakes, and so as a result, they may be willing to do it at a discount. And so they would be taking that. So they would be taking that that discount, not StepStone who is buying it. So potentially, for example, the portfolio could be marked at 98, but StepStone's going to buy at 95. The 3 points difference would actually be would be the LP that's selling that would take the hit.
Good, thank you.
Yep. Any other questions?
Yes, I had a quick question, Ariel, on the same slide.
Yep.
Is there a particular reason why there's such a lag on private credit data? Because we're now about to go to 2 years behind. So is there some reason for that lag?
In terms of, you mean the 2020 data that we're showing?
Well, it's actually showing private credit shows 2019 data. Does not show 2020, and we're about to finish 2021 on the far right-hand side, average pricing.
You're not seeing the 2020 right here?
I'm not seeing the private credit line. It seems to
Sorry, you're seeing the buy-up, but not the private credit?
Right.
That's a good question. I need to check on that. I think there's just a little bit of I don't have a good answer. There shouldn't be that type of lag, frankly. It's likely that the data just hasn't caught up yet, but we should have the 2020 data shortly.
Okay, because, you know, otherwise we're missing 2 years. So
yeah. Jerry, it's Dennis. It looks like the data is here. It just coincides with the buyout because it says 90 on top and 90 on the bottom. Let's say
I think you are right. I apologize.
So you think they overlap then?
Yeah, I think they overlap. Yes. The same as with 19, because there are two percentages, one on top, one on the bottom. So it looks like both of them are the same percent.
Okay, all right. Well, that's two different answers, but that's all right. You could be right, Dennis. You could be right, Ariel. So.
No, I apologize. I think Dennis is right. I'm seeing the two 90s. Apologies right. for that.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions?
I don't see any. Go ahead. Carry on.
So then as we think about other opportunities, you know, at StepStone, we are always trying to identify new options for deployment across the market. So senior traditional lending, which is slightly lower yielding than your typical unitranche loans and is primarily sourced from banks versus GPs, is a new area that we think is quite interesting. We believe it's a unique opportunity just because you can deploy large amounts of capital given the banks need to reduce their risk taking. And then lastly, before I turn it back over to Marcel to summarize, you know, I think everyone, you know, would acknowledge that the pandemic has led to many, many changes in the market and probably in most people's daily lives. And most of these situations really have a common denominator, and that's that it's very hard to finance these specialty finance type lending situations in the public markets. And so that provides opportunities for GPs and for StepStone alike to participate in what we call this more specialty lending market, which is, as we said, is kind of in between two very large established markets being corporate direct lending and hard, you know, and basically hard assets backed lending. And I will turn it over to Marcel to just summarize.
Yeah, just very quickly here, Ariel, thank you very much. We've talked enough, I think, about the market, where valuation stand or rates are. We all know that we see hardly any defaults in the market, which is obviously a consequence as well of the intervention and the support that we've seen. Ariel just talked about, you know, what's happening on the credit supply side. I mentioned before that the refinancings come in more frequently, and that spreads in certain core markets even tighten. We see more LP demand generally, so more flow going into private markets, which obviously will lead to one consequence that I mentioned before. Yes, agreed, relative attractiveness has increased compared to public markets, but if we look at absolute return levels, they're coming slightly in compared to what we have seen previously. I think that is just in full awareness and eyes wide open what we currently see. And that is one reason why we are looking for alternative deployment opportunities in the market, because cash flows come back. They might not be reinvested at the same type of yields that we've used to do. And we want to make sure we're not staying cash on any of the mandates that we're looking at. With that, if there are no further questions, I will go into the review of the program.
A quick question, if I could, please.
Please.
It looks to me as if the Biden administration has gotten off the spin about how the inflation is transitory. That was several months ago, and now it's transitory, probably well into 2022. So it's just a long transition. Probably that means the Fed will have to step in at some point and raise interest rates to cool things off. What kind of impact do you think it'll have on this kind of investment?
I think in general, the analysis that we did and how we look as well, how we calculate interest and amortization coverage, you know, interest moves of 1% to 2%, which would already be substantial in my mind, they normally would be absorbed reasonably well and actually would have a positive overall impact on the yield that we currently see. Extreme rate moves, you know, beyond that, what I've just mentioned, in very short period, it's hard to assess, considering especially, I believe, the first impact would then be immediately on equities to a much larger extent, which has a consequent indirectly, again, on the credit side, you know, and probably could even trigger, you know, a certain number of defaults in the industries. So I believe whoever starts moving interest needs to do this very, very carefully and with some foresight to make sure markets understand what's going to happen. But we mentioned before interest rate coverage, you know, for example, fixed charge coverage, you know, is an important measure that, that we monitor and see. So we believe, you know, the companies can absorb quite a bit more from what we see currently. So in a first move, the first few moves, we don't see a challenge, actually. It's in the benefit of the investors, ultimately, in higher yields.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions. Go ahead.
That's my part. Thank you for that.
All right.
Apologies for not turning on the camera because I got stuck in traffic while driving to my parents and sitting on actually a fuel station. Sorry for that. So briefly recap on the history of the mandate. The mandate was approved 4.5 years ago, implementation with the green investment guidelines, manager selection, the investing and started investing in the following quarters. To March 2021, we had commitments out of almost 1 billion. As Rishi said at the beginning, the vast bulk of it is in five SMAs. And the portfolio construction, et cetera, has been discussed. And also everything is based on investment guidelines. We do have biweekly calls, as also mentioned already, for updates, manager ideas, proposals. The monitoring is a very important part. We do quarterly, fairly detailed review calls. And that has actually found a very, very good rhythm. Outlook for the next 9 to 12 months, the implementation is continuing in line with the plan. The fifth SMA actually was signed at the end of September, so about a month ago, and will start investing or has started investing. We'll make one or two more primary fund investments in the next 6 to 9 months and then continuing on that. And the recycling of capital, not only co-investment, but on all the mandates is obviously key so that you keep on earning a yield. On the next page, the mandate is up to 13% of the Cesera's AUM. It's mainly corporate debt, but it can also venture a bit into real estate or other asset classes. The target is a net IRR of 10%. It was always mentioned over a cycle, but in the document itself, it actually says 10%. And we apply different and flexible implementation techniques, which can be separately managed accounts, as we said, co-investments, secondaries, but also primary funds. And that was is the essence of the mandate, to get the best possible result for Cesera. The pacing analysis, the target of 13%, which was increased to 13% about a year ago, will under the current plan will be achieved by 2024. You see that on the right-hand scale. We're currently at around 9%, so a fairly significant amount already. And the short and medium-term plan is in place to reach this aim in the next couple of years. We always show you a brief activity report, although quite a few things have been said already. We have these bi-weekly calls. We reviewed 15 different opportunities across 7 different strategies. So we talk about a lot of different ideas and strategies to educate Cesera as well on what's out there. Lots of due diligence meetings, as Rishi also said, and are always in the middle of discussing a few opportunities. And the new SMA that started just now has been mentioned a couple of times as well. That is a brief intro to the history of the program, how we go about it, activity report, open for questions.
There are questions for Urs on this portion of the presentation. Not seeing any right now. Urs?
Quick question.
Oh, we do have one. David.
Yeah, the target return is 10%, but do you have a upper and lower, what the range is and what you expect on that? I mean, is the minimum return 6% that you see and the max maybe 14? Do you have a range?
The range in private credit tends to be a bit tighter. I would say it's more, and we haven't set the range. So the question is not officially in the documentation because it's over the cycle. So, but the range through a cycle is more like in the 8 to 12% range. If there are issues, it may drop to 8 for a while, and then credit tends to offer interesting opportunities and allow for outsized return for a while. And that's why the 10 over time is the target, but it's about 8 to 12, I would say.
Okay, well, I appreciate that because with our target for Cesera in returns, if it's looking like 8% is pretty solid, then that's actually reassuring for us meeting our return needs overall.
Any other questions for Urs? Oh, no, I don't see one. So you may continue.
Great, then I'll take over for the last section and kind of the meat of the presentation, as Rishi calls it. So this slide that we're seeing in front of you, this serves as a high-level overview of the sequential progression for the performance and portfolio statistics of Cesera's private debt portfolio up until March 31st, 2021. So as of the same period last year, which was March 31st, 2020, the portfolio was not surprisingly in a very different state of performance, characterized largely by the market environment that we were in, you know, due to the onset of COVID-19. So at the time, as of March 31st, 2020, we had a 4.1% gross IRR. So just to clarify, that is net of manager fees, but not net of StepStone fees. And so net of StepStone fees would be 3% on that slide. This bounced back quite significantly by the year end, December 2020, to be 9.5% on a gross basis. And today is squarely in line with that 10% gross IRR expectation, which is a 9.3% net IRR, so net of all fees since inception. And so I think what's important is that even through COVID-19 and the volatile market that pursued, we want to highlight that this the portfolio statistics, if you look at them, I don't know if you can see my arrow down here, remain generally consistent and conservative, which was characterized by modest leverage levels, so in that 4.5 range, and virtually all first lien with at least one covenant We believe that this type of conservative structuring, which comprises all of the direct lending investments for Sisera and makes up about 89% of the portfolio, is really what helps support the strong rebound and resilience through the market disruption from COVID-19. Any questions on this slide before I move to benchmarking?
Go ahead, yeah.
Perfect. Given Sisera's investment objectives of generating a 10% IRR over a cycle, we like to look at the since inception date chart on the right, and that's where we'll focus on most today. And so what you can see is that Sisera's portfolio since inception in 2018 has outperformed, and a little bit about why we chose these two benchmarks. So first, the Cliffwater Direct Lending Index. This is an asset-weighted index of about a little over 7,000 directly originated middle market loans. And this is comprised of about 72% senior debt and 14% sub debt, with the rest, you know, equity and other categories. This data is highly reputable given it's sourced from the reporting of publicly traded BDCs. And though it's not perfectly apples to apples with Sisera's portfolio, we would argue Sisera's portfolio is not too far off from the complexion of the Cliffwater Index, given about 90% of Sisera's fund level exposure is in direct lending, which makes up approximately 86% of the Cliffwater Index, falling into either senior or sub debt categories. And then in addition, the Cliffwater Index only tracks the US geography, which is in line with Sisera's portfolio. So we also included the S&P LSTA, as this is one of the standard benchmarks in the industry in the leveraged loan space, but it focuses much more on liquid credits versus illiquid credits.
Is there, Ariel, is there an argument to be made that there's a better benchmark that we're not using?
So we would argue no, there are very few good benchmarks in private debt. The other one we've looked at is Burgess, but it has such a small sample size. It's about, you know, couple hundred loans, and so it's just not comparable and not that accurate. So Cliffwater really is the best index we could find. And then, as I said, the beauty of the S&P LSTA is it's just the standard in the leveraged loan industry, but you know, it's a little bit more focused on liquid versus illiquid, you know, and obviously Sisera's portfolio is primarily illiquid.
All right, thank you.
Ariel,
sure.
With the Cliffwater at 13.7, how do fees fit into that? I mean, if you were to take StepStone net of fees compared to Cliffwater, what would that comparison look like?
Yeah, so we don't have perfect apples to apples with Cliffwater. So the Cliffwater 13.7% we believe is gross, whereas our is the gross IRR, which is actually net of manager fees. So we're penalizing ourselves a little bit versus Cliffwater.
It's actually, I can confirm that that's gross of fees. Because they report really the underlying loans. It's not investable like that, but they have all the data of the underlying loans, which they accumulate, aggregate, and produce an index, which I think is very interesting, you know, as a benchmark. It's still not investable. It doesn't carry any fees. So it's a high benchmark.
So we're basically penalizing ourselves because we are including in our gross IRR the manager fees.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And so if we think about the last two slides, which are cash flow analysis and then overall portfolio exposure, I'll focus first on the cash flow analysis on this page. And so what you can see is, you know, deployment and distributions, you know, quarter over quarter remain relatively consistent over the last five quarters, you know, with almost $300 million deployed in the last year. The three SMAs before we made the fourth SMA make up the largest portion of the portfolio and account for about 70% of the deployment. And then if we look at just the overall, portfolio exposure, direct lending, as we discussed, is the biggest piece of the portfolio, and it accounts for almost 90% of the portfolio. The portfolio is 100% North American focused, and as you can see on the bottom left chart, highly diversified by industry. So that ends, that concludes our prepared remarks. Happy to take any additional questions from the board and appreciate your time.
Thank you. Are there other or further questions for our StepStone team? I'm looking, Ariel, here to see if we have anybody else. I don't see any. So with that, thank you very much. Very informative, very interesting, pretty significant exposure for us, as you know. So there's a lot of interest in this, and we appreciate the presentation and the information, and look forward to hopefully seeing you in person one of these days.
Great. Same. Thanks.
Looking forward to. Thanks a lot to everybody.
All right, thank you all. Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right.
Scott, yes. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Tim or Rishi, with this allocation, it appears a couple of advantages. One is capital preservation that was mentioned during the presentation, and then the other is the returns on this are still higher than our expected returns for Cicera. So that seems like a win in two categories. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I'd largely agree with that. I mean, we took a look at private credit as a new asset class in 2015. And you know, I think we spent a lot of time getting our heads around what does this actually mean? What's going to do for us as a replacement for the public bond market, or is it something different? And, you know, we said, you know, this is direct lending to largely private equity sponsors, so largely tied to the U.S. Private equity industry, and we put it in the growth category as a result. You know, I think the expected returns from 2015 were dramatically higher than what they are today, but, you know, still strong. You know, we reaffirmed that we'd like to have this as a key component of the growth portfolio last year in the asset allocation study. Excuse me. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's offering reasonably high rates of return. One of the most attractive pieces of it is it's still debt. So it still has a limited downside. Now, this is levered. It is, you know, loans to smaller companies. There is more credit risk here. It's certainly not as safe as a, you know, core fixed income portfolio by any stretch of the imagination. This is credit exposure to smaller companies. But on a looking forward basis, it looks attractive from a risk reward perspective and from a return perspective overall. And I think we've seen that borne out to date.
Just want to throw a quick comment in, David. This is part of our growth portfolio. And in order for us to hit our 7% overall assumption, we have to do better than 7.
Right.
In the growth portfolio, I don't know if we've pinned down exactly what that is, but clearly it needs to be closer to 10 than 7.
Right.
In order to have an overall return of 7.
Well, that's why I asked about a range of expectations, because I wanted them just to tell us in more or less the worst case scenario, what can we at the very least expect to get back? And if we're under those circumstances, if we're able to get 8% and our target is 7, then okay. I mean, the upside could be up to 12% or whatever. But I think that helps us reach our goals.
Yeah. I mean, with the caveat that the possible range of outcomes is always broader than the likely range of outcomes, I think that's reasonable. Veris's assumptions in the capital markets study, or Veris's capital market assumptions in the asset allocation study we did last year, were on the lower side of that. But, you know, I think still a reasonably strong contribution to the overall growth portfolio is coming from the private credit space.
And I might just chime in here quickly. I agree with everything that Tim said. You know, as you guys might recall, last year we showed a range of private credit investments. We explained that private credit's a very broad asset class, and so there are lower returning, lower risk strategies in private credit, like infrastructure debt, for example. And then there are much higher octane strategies like distressed and special situations and structured credit. Direct lending, levered direct lending, sort of falls somewhere in the middle in terms of those risk profiles. And so we've been very focused on trying to stay in that risk profile. And because we stay in that risk profile, you know, the range of outcomes, we're trying to keep them narrower. But, you know, as Tim mentioned, also, you know, there Veris had different expectations on this. But that's a little bit more color on what we've been trying to stay within the private credit profile. We've been trying to stay in that sort of middle risk, middle return range.
Any further comments or questions for Rishi or Tim? Don't see any. See, Ariel's still on as well. So if, I don't know if there are any further or final questions. Doesn't look like it. So, all right. Well, thank you.